Beth Fratkin is joining me. This is Larry Warren, and welcome to Mountain Money. And should be a pretty good show. Should be a pretty good day here with mostly sunny skies predicted and an unheard of high of like 45 degrees. But it'll be nice out there. And we have an excellent show today. We have Mike Leavitt. That name is certainly familiar to everyone in Utah. He's been a three-term governor, and after the governorship, he moved on to Washington. President Bush, H.W. Bush, no, not H.W. Bush, but W. Bush, the second Bush. It's so confusing. I asked Governor Leavitt to join his cabinet, where he served as both Environmental Protection Secretary and then Secretary of Health and Human Services. So he will be our first guest this morning. He has a new book out, and should be interesting discussion.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to him. On the second half of the show, we'll be talking to Joe Dobro. He's the author of Natural Profits, From Health Food to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. So that's a pretty interesting story about how the hippies that just wanted to promote good eating and sunshine and healthy food turned into whole food.
And now the hippies are corporate conglomerates.
Yes, yes. So this will be a good conversation. We're looking forward to talking to him.
So we'll join the conversation right after this break. Stay tuned.
This is Sean Railton. I'm an agent with Park City Realty Group. I'm a 30-year Park City resident and a KPCW underwriter. I have been involved in the Park City real estate market since 1994 as an agent, an appraiser, and an investor. I can be reached at 649-1991 or Sean at ParkCityRealtyGroup.com.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And welcome back to Mountain Money, and we're very pleased to have Governor Mike Leavitt with us on the line. Are you there, Governor?
Larry, I'm here, ready to talk.
Well, great. Glad to have you back on the program. Let me just run through a couple of statistics, because this is very interesting. When you joined George W. Bush's cabinet in 2003, you were at the EPA for a couple of years and then moved on for a four-year stint as Secretary of Health and Human Services, which had a $750 billion budget, 25% of the entire federal budget, and 67,000 employees. And that's just remarkable. I can't imagine how you manage a monster like that. But we're going to talk about your book, Finding Allies and Building Alliances, Eight Key Elements That Bring and Keep People Together. Now, you've been in politics. You were chairman of the party before you became governor and then moved on to Washington. I presume from the very start you realized you're not in that alone. You need alliances and allies.
Well, Larry, I've discovered in life generally, but certainly underscored in politics, that complex things require lots of people to work together to solve them. And the book is really a summation of lessons that that I learned in that process, ways to do it more efficiently. I'm frankly persuaded that the 21st century is a period of time when those who are most adept at collaborative problem solving will be the prosperous ones, whether that's a nation or a community or a business or a neighborhood.
Yeah, can I ask, are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm not. I'm on a landline.
Okay.
It's a cordless. Is that a problem?
Well, it's a little scratchy, but we'll get by. I'd rather have you on the air than not on the air. So, let's talk about the book itself for a bit. Collaboration is crucial to success, but Is that a message that doesn't get through to a lot of people running complex organizations?
I think most people recognize the truth of what I said earlier, that solving complex problems requires effective collaboration. That's a point we didn't feel in the book needed to be made, so we got right down to the business of, once you realize that, how do you do it better? And we concluded through a lot of experience that that in order for collaboration to work, you have to have people at the table who are motivated to do things that might not seem intuitive to them. And so the first of the eight elements that we talk about in the book is what I refer to as common pain. That is to say, something that is vexing them that they need a solution to that they can't get to on their own. And once a group of people all experience some form of motivation, whether it's pain or opportunity, then they are often willing to come together and do things that they wouldn't do just naturally, or that they wouldn't do if just left to their own device.
Well, it's obviously, to solve a problem, people have to have a problem, so you have to define that problem as well. But how do you get people to get on the same page, even though they have a common problem? In business, for example, in some of your examples in the book with SureScripts and other things like that, you have people who are competing for advantage. So how do you get them to see that there's, with collaboration, they can reach a consensus?
Well, the second of the eight elements is what we refer to as a convener of stature. That is a person or group of people or individual, or rather a group that has stature among the group that can begin to bring them together and talk through how a collaborative solution might be better, and then takes charge of structuring the collaborative exercise. And we think the structure is very important. And so the first step is having this convener of stature, someone who has enough respect within the group that they can bring them together. In the book, we use an example that I think is important from American history, and that is the Constitutional Convention. You had a bunch of colony states that had just won their independence, and they were all feeling very independent and didn't want to have a central government. But ultimately, it wasn't working, and so they had to have a convener of stature. In this case, it turned out to be George Washington, who had enough stature with the group that if he would participate, then the others would come. And so almost every successful collaboration has a convener of stature.
And so that convener of stature is able to see that collaboration is better than competition, and that they don't need to fight for their place on the hierarchy.
Well, that's one of the jobs of the convener of stature, is to a respected and influential presence who can bring people to the table, and when necessary can keep them there. George Washington sat in the corner of the room, really, and just made certain everyone was there, and then made certain they were on their best behavior, and people respected him so much they weren't inclined to act out as much. And in a collaboration, you see that all the time. If it's the CEO bringing different departments together as the convener, then that's one of the CEO's role. Or if it's a public official, or if it's a respected person in the neighborhood, or it could be a combination of two or three people who have the respect. But that role of a convener of stature is when that element is missing, either the groups never get together or they don't stay together.
Okay, and the other people in the room, you've talked about the common pain and the convener of stature, and then the third element of your recipe here is all those others in the room, along with George Washington, have to be representatives of substance. So how do you pick the others in the room?
Well, I've been involved in collaborative exercises where people agreed that they would all get together to solve a problem, and then they sent someone to the meeting that was just not able to represent the position of either that group or that individual. You have to have people in the room who can decide on behalf of that group or person whether or not this is a good thing. Without that, a group of collaborative of participants just don't have the ability to get things done. And when it comes right down to it, this book is about how you get things done when things are complex and lots of people are involved. And that's a critical element, having the right people at the table, people who can act on behalf of their organizations or persuade others to follow the conclusion of the collaboration.
Get back to the book, but let's talk about collaborating and getting things done through allies and alliances. How do you run a beast like Health and Human Services with 67,000 employees? I mean, that must have been daunting when you day one when you step into a job like that.
Well, it does require many of the lessons that I've talked about in the book have been drawn from that and other experiences like it. Because even though I was the head of the department and I was given constitutional authority to manage that department, when you've got 67,000 people who are involved, you obviously can't just do it from the top down. You have to involve people and begin to establish very clear objectives and help them buy into it and then reward them when they do and guide them when they don't. I also found that it was very important to recognize that there was a limit to the number of things you could do and that you had to prioritize. One component of a government role that's unique is that you have two different kinds of employees, those who are there by political appointment and those that are there as career employees. And I found that those who treated them differently and treated the career employees as though they were in some ways not as important suffered a failure as their fate. I learned very early that I needed to gain the confidence and to treat with great respect the people who had been there before I got there and that would be there after I left.
Yeah, one of the big things you had to implement at HHS was Medicare Part D, and that was something that involved 43 million seniors and seemed to be implemented with the right software and hardware and buy-in by the public, and that seems like a great a success of yours, contrasted with trying the bigger rollout of the Affordable Care Act. What went right with Part D and wrong with Affordable Care Act?
Well, I suspect that much will be written about that over the course of the future, but I would just observe generally that success in that kind of implementation starts very early. And I believe that the seed of the Affordable Care Act's failure were sown more than a year for the actual date of implementation. They made decisions that started with deferring important decisions until after the election. And when they deferred important decisions, all of the other collaborators who had to be involved had no leadership or guidance. Consequently, the whole system began to fall behind schedule.
Well,
another component of that was that they, and it really goes back to the book, and that is there has to be a committed leader. I'm not talking about President Obama. I'm talking about the fact that they did not put anybody, any single person, in charge of the whole project. And I think that was a very significant flaw in their plan.
What about the political situation surrounding the whole passage of the act when you have people that simply do not want to collaborate to solve their common pain? It seems like, you know, it was doomed to failure just from that.
Politics is part of the environment that both the Affordable Care Act and Medicare Part D had to work through. In the Medicare Part D rollout, we had exactly the same things being said. They wanted to delay it. They thought it was the only thing that changed was that one party was saying it at one time and the other party was saying exactly the same thing for the Affordable Care Act. It's just politics. So there was a political failure in both cases to be able to bring both parties together, but the big failure that has distinguished the Affordable Care Act from the Medicare Part D was that the systems and the preparation for one was better than the other.
Now, after your long involvement in healthcare issues going back to your insurance days, and I should mention that you are the founder and builder of and chairman now of Levitt Partners, and you helped build or did build the Levitt Group insurance companies into this, what, the second biggest in America that's privately owned?
Yes. I've not been part of that business for several years. My brothers are, I like to say, doing discouragingly well in my absence. I thought they'd need me more than they turned out to. So they're pretty smart guys and have done very well.
But in any event, through all your experiences and of course, Republican and conservative somewhat from Utah, what do you think of the Affordable Care Act in general? We hear a lot of success stories now, people who could not have gotten insurance before because of pre-existing conditions, or people who finally feel liberated to leave their job and follow their dreams because they can now take their insurance with them instead of being stuck in a job. Just overall, in terms of principle, does the Affordable Care Act look as bad as it has to most Republicans since the beginning?
Well, I think we all have to acknowledge that anytime there's something as politically hot as the Affordable Care Act was and is going to be surrounded by political controversy. I think there's a widely held aspiration in our country for people to have access to an affordable insurance policy, and I think that goal is shared across the political spectrum. The debate over the Affordable Care Act is really boiled down into a couple of key questions. The first is, what is the role of government in health care? The Democrat Party pursued policies that would enhance and increase the amount of involvement that the federal government would have in the administration of health care and particularly its payment system. Republicans have valued more the ability for consumers to make choices and to look after their interests inside the framework of government. So, in other words, Democrats would like to see the government more involved in operating the system, and Republicans would like to see government involved in organizing the system. That's a very long-standing dispute, and one that will continue, I might add. But the outcome of the Affordable Care Act thus far has done nothing but fuel that controversy. Personally, I think it's easy to see that there are things that come from this that people will value, and I think those things will stay over time. There have also been a number of things that people haven't valued, and I think those will ultimately be changed. So I see this as an ongoing public discussion that isn't that's really just beginning, not just ending.
And presumably, once all the kinks are worked out, because as you said, they should have started a lot earlier, that we'll see more and more success stories, and hopefully,
well, time will tell. I mean, I think that there's no question that having people have insurance is a positive thing we all applaud. On the other hand, what we don't know is what the economic impact on the country will be. The cost is over $1 trillion over a 10-year period. We've got an $18 trillion debt and running a very large deficit right now. And so it's the impact of the Affordable Care Act will not be judged just in how many people get insurance. It will be judged by what it did to the country and our capacity to prosper economically.
Yeah, you know, of course, the ACA only passed by a few votes. We have a very divided Congress. Maybe you should send a copy of your book or 535 copies to the members of the House and Senate, because have you seen a time where Congress has been more deadlocked and with heels dug in and absolutely saying no to each other? It seems like in the old days, you know, Senator Hatch and Senator Kennedy were able to put forth a lot of really nice, good legislation for the American people, and you don't see that kind of reaching across the aisles anymore. Do they need to learn your eight principles here?
I think we all find that a bit discouraging, and the popularity of Congress is suffering, and I hope in time that we will see situations where that will improve. However, I do think it's interesting to point out that there are moments when government has the ability to act, and generally it's when there's enough common pain that people will drive it forward. And so Congress and the government is essentially a collaborative body. It's an organized collaboration that was designed with certain checks and balances that would make it difficult for things to occur, so that government wouldn't just tell us everything that they wanted us to do. I think it's gone to more of an extreme than any of us are comfortable with, and see some very serious problems we'd like government to deal with. So I do think those 535 copies of the book, Finding Allies and Building Alliances, might do some good.
Do you think that the part of the problem, or one part of the problem, is that there are so many warring factions within the Republican Party, for example, the Tea Party pushing on one end and the more traditional Republicans and more centrist Republicans sticking to their end? Do you think that's part of the problem?
Well, that seems to be part of the landscape today. If we go back a few years ago, we'll see the Democrats doing exactly the same thing. That's just the way politics works, I'm afraid. There are things, however, that I believe cause that to be more acute. And I think we've got one of them in Utah, and it's the caucus system that we have, where very few people make the decision on who gets to run for office. And under that system, people can be completely eliminated from having any influence. And as you may know, there's a group of Utahns now, I am among them, who are working to change that system through a proposal we call Count My Vote, which would replace a system that no one really understands and very few participate in, causing people to be chosen. Many members of our legislature, for example, are chosen by fewer than 100 people. We'd like to change that, and so there's petitions being passed for people to be able to put that on the ballot. I'd like to be able to make that point today. I hope people will sign that, because the more people can be involved in our democracy, the more rational our decisions will be, and I think that we need to hold people accountable for that.
I kind of figured at some point here you'd work in Count My Vote.
Hey, how did that do, Larry?
One final question, and it's political as well. Your party, Republicans, seem, because they're being pulled from the center and the far right with the Tea Party, seems a little out of sync with the American public, with gay rights for one, and just diversity of the party for another, and opposition to Affordable Care Act, things like that. Is your party in the process of turmoil and in need of some alliance building to build it for the next generation. I think the next generation of voters doesn't understand why gay rights is an issue, and things like that, and diversity is taken for granted everywhere. Is the Republican Party getting a little out of step with the future?
Larry, are you saying if every Republican bought a copy of Finding Allies, Building Alliances, America would be a better place?
Certainly. That's certainly what
Well, that's exactly what I meant.
Okay. But it's just politics. If you went back to the point in time where the Democrats had lost an election or two, you'd see a lot of soul searching going on, and that's just the way politics works. It's the marketplace of ideas, and so I think that there is rethinking that has to be done in a party like mine when we turn out to have disappointments. That's certainly going on right now.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. Thanks very much for joining us, Governor Mike Leavitt. He's just written the book with Rich McEwen, I should add, McCowan.
Rich McEwen is the fellow that's been with me together. We've had many experiences in government together and in business, and he's been a full partner in writing this book.
Very good. And the book, Finding Allies, Building Alliances, 8 Elements That Bring and Keep People Together. Thanks for joining us, Governor.
Thank you to both of you, and have a great day.
Okay, you too. And we will be back with more Mountain Money and talk about the organic food industry and how it's grown from hippie communes to Whole Foods and other companies like them after this.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Just because it's white outside doesn't mean you can't stay green.
Listen to This Green Earth every Tuesday at 9 a.m.
Discussing environmental issues from methane gas to moose habitat.
Air quality to fire ecology.
And bark beetles to eating bugs.
That's This Green Earth, brought to you by
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Good morning. Welcome back to Mountain Money. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM. We're just about to have a conversation with Joe Dobro. He's the author of Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. Are you on the line there, Joe?
I am, Beth. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, too. Thanks for having me on.
So can you give us an idea of your background before we start talking about the subject of your book?
Yeah, absolutely. I have spent most of my career as a marketing executive in the natural foods industry. So I spent a number of years as the head of marketing for Whole Foods Market and for one of its predecessor companies. And then a couple of stops in between, but more recently with a company that some of your listeners might be familiar with called Sprouts Farmers Market, which has rapidly grown into the second largest retailer in the natural foods industry. And they've got a few locations in Salt Lake City at this point. So most of my career has been spent peddling tofu one way or another.
Well, why don't we start with the question of when did foods become unnatural and why?
That's a good question. And it really was an astonishingly fast turnaround, because if you think back, really within our accessible lifetimes, when our grandparents were in their primes, all food was natural and organic. We just didn't call it that. But what happened was that just at the end of World War II, when all of the gearworks and the material that had been used to create war machine needed a new use, much of it got converted to agriculture. And so in a heartbeat, evolutionarily speaking, we went from this world of natural and organic to one that was synthetic and unnatural. And very quickly you had the release of DDT as a initially a military tool to become an agricultural one. It became very quickly the most popular pesticide in the country. And on its heels, you had the development of 80,000 new chemical compounds and about 5,000 new food additives. So it was really in the space of, I would say, less than two decades after World War II, in which we saw that pendulum swing from all natural and organic to no natural and organic.
And then can you trace a decline of health or an increase in certain types of heart problems to the growing unnaturalness of processed foods? I mean, has it proven that we now have food that hurts us when we eat it?
You know, it's a controversial question, because for every answer that points to one study saying, yes, there are direct linkages there, there's probably another study that points to the opposite answer. But I don't think that anybody who is a logical thinker can look at what has happened in the world today, especially in this country, with the rapid increase in food allergies that did not exist, or at least were largely unheard of when we were kids, or look at the obesity epidemic, or look at the rates of cancer and heart disease and things like that, and not somehow connect the dotted lines back to what has happened in the food industry. You know, that old saying, you are what you eat, and I think at this point what we are is kind of indeterminate, because there's so many chemicals that have entered the human body and have changed us evolution. An amazing fact, but true, is newborns now, on average, have 232 traces of chemicals in their systems.
Yeah,
they haven't ingested any food yet.
Yeah,
but there's 232 chemicals in their systems.
Yeah, that's a tragedy, I think, from any point of view. But let's go back and talk about, you know, after the war and when this trend started accelerating, there were a few farmers and people that were devoted to raising alarms about this, but it really didn't pick up steam, the natural foods area or product line, until the 60s, when all these hippies decided that, you know, they wanted to eat tofu.
Back to nature.
It was like when I first started buying food on my own, I wouldn't have been caught dead going into a natural food store unless I was wearing patchouli oil and was half stoned. You know, so how did we get from there to the situation where we're in now, where people are, you know, Whole Foods is one of the fastest growing companies in the country?
Yeah. Well, that's really the story of my book, of Natural Profits, because what happened was, you had this generation born in the first wave of the baby boom, right at the end of World War II, up into the mid-50s, that as they came of age, they just, as a matter of compunction, sort of naturally rejected the business world around them. And there had been so much change in food and in farming, and in the way that Madison Avenue was writing catchy jingles to get us to eat Mounds bars and drink Coke and what have you, that this generation really started to rebel against that. The problem was that they really had no infrastructure with which to do that, because all that existed at that point were a scattering of backwater health food stores and some isolated farms and, as you were saying, Beth, just some really weird products. You know, the co-ops and the health food stores of that era were really small. They always had these wood slat floors and bins full of bulk brown rice or peanut butter or honey, and Asian products that nobody had ever heard of. and the fruit was terrible. In fact, there's a chapter in the book called A Few Gnarly Pieces of Produce, and that's really the description of what the organic fruit looked like in that day. So this group of people, and this included folks like Mo Siegel, who went on to become the founder of Celestial Seasonings Tea, or Gene Kahn, who created Cascadian Farm, or John Mackey, who was the co-founder of Whole Foods Market. As they came up through this era, they began to recognize that there was some real business potential out there, and that if somehow you could begin to focus the capital and professionalize the merchandising and expand the size of the stores and of the supply side, that there were lots of people out there who would potentially have interest in this.
Yeah, and you write about the Boulder Mafia, and that's where Celestial Seasonings grew from, Mo Siegel. Why don't you briefly tell his story?
Yeah, Larry, there's a great story about Mo Siegel. He was born in the Rocky Mountains and grew up as a real outdoorsy kid. Went off to Vail, was selling posters in a little health food store there, kind of following the events of the 60s and, you know, the March on Washington and the Democratic Convention and all of that. And he started to go off and pick herbs in the mountains and realized that you could make really good tea with this. And it was very different than the Lipton teas and the black teas of the world, which dominated the market at that point. So he had no idea how to create a business. None of these natural prophets did. And he moved to Boulder and hooked up with a couple of people that he thought would be able to help him. And at one point, he goes into a bank with his business plan, and he tells them he's going to build a $100 million business. He just needs to start out with a $10,000 loan. And he brings in Tupperware containers of his fragrant herbs and what have you. And they're sitting in the bank manager's office, which is his glass-walled office. The bank manager is very cordial and asks them to hold on and says, would it be okay if I brought in some of my colleagues because I'd like them to hear your story too? And they say, good. And a couple of minutes later, there's other three-piece suitors in the room, and they're listening to Mo Siegel and his colleague, and they shake hands and they leave. And as Mo is leaving the bank, he looks back up at this glass office and he sees them all laughing hysterically. Because he realizes that this was just a big joke to them.
Yeah, I wonder if they're laughing now.
No, of course, Celestial went on to become Hain Celestial, and they are on the manufacturing side of the natural foods industry what Whole Foods is on the retail side. They own everybody. And they are a dominant force.
Yeah, and what was the breakthrough moment from them when they started being able? I mean, after they were able to figure out distribution and that kind of thing. One of the things that you mentioned in the book is that their packaging was so much better than anyone had done in that industry beforehand. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, very true. I liken the packaging breakthrough of Celestial Seasonings to that moment in The Wizard of Oz when we land in Oz and it goes from black and white to Technicolor, because the health food stores of the 60s were really drab affairs. I mean, all the food was brown.
Yeah, and the packaging was brown butcher paper and brown bags.
If that. You know, a lot of it was, as they say, it was just sort of this you know, bulk bins. And the reason for that was obvious, because this was a fledgling industry. They weren't going to waste any money on packaging and marketing. They just wanted to get it right from the farm into the store. But Celestial saw it differently. And this was really Mo Siegel's baby. And he created packages right from the start, very similar to what you see today for Celestial. Vivid colors, beautiful illustrations, philosophical sayings on the side of them. And his view was that if you could create packaging that attracted people into the store, and then they happened to discover after that, hey, this product really tastes good, then you could cross over from the fringe natural foods customers into the mainstream. And that's exactly what happened. You know, Celestial, along with a couple of other products like Tom's of Maine and Frookies was an interesting one that I tell about in the book. These were among the very first products that had been born on the natural and organic side that did start to appear on the mainstream shelves of the Smiths and Safeways and Albertsons of the world.
So once the industry discovered the power of distribution networks and marketing and packaging, did that lay the seeds for them to take off?
A little bit, but it really still took some outside forces. And one of those happened 25 years ago this month, which, again, if you think about it, not really all that long ago. But in February of 1989, a report from the National Resources Defense Council had come out about the chemical agent ALAR, A-L-A-R, which was widely used on fruits and in particular on apples back in the day. And the report said that it was a possible carcinogen, and they actually enumerated how many school children they thought could die as a result of ingesting apples and apple products with ALAR, which they pegged at 6,000. And this was a very frightening event, which was magnified by the fact that on February 26th of 1989, 60 Minutes ran a piece about it, a very controversial piece.
And
that was followed a couple of weeks later by a big article in Newsweek that was called Panic for Organic. And that's what happened. It was, in a very short order, a media blitz that created fear. And that galvanized a lot of the efforts that the people like Mo Siegel and Gene Kahn and John Mackey had been working on diligently, but pretty much out of view up until that point. And now you started to get it. Now you started to see mainstream America really understand for the first time what had happened to their food products and some of the risks that we were all now facing.
Can you talk about John Mackey?
Sure.
You could go on and on about him. Yeah, the big supermarkets now are what I presume Whole Foods is the largest, but maybe Sprouts is catching up.
Yeah, I mean, Whole Foods started in 1980, so they had quite a head start, and they're an amazing company. I mean, they're number 232 on the Fortune 500 list right now. They're the eighth largest food and drug public food and drug company in the United States, which really is amazing when you think about where they started and what they were selling. Sprouts started much more recently, in 2002, and their stores are smaller, and they're kind of more hybrid stores that offer some conventional foods as well as some natural, a lot of natural organic foods. But John is really one of the major focuses of the book. He was a fascinating guy to work for, and I'm really glad that I had that opportunity. He was somebody who, he's got a really facile mind. He's a very competitive guy, very intellectual guy. But he had dropped out of college several times, never earned a degree, just sort of wandered and found himself in Austin and in the natural foods industry, such as it was. But he had a vision. And unlike the rest of the natural foods retailers of the day, which were companies like New Frontiers in Salt Lake City or Mrs. Gooch's in Los Angeles or Bread and Circus in Boston, which were all regional players and never really saw beyond that, John had this vision, and he alone looked into the future and thought that natural foods really could become a force, not just in the food industry, but influencing all industry. And that what needed to happen was that you needed to educate customers about what the differences were and why it was important and perhaps worthwhile to spend a few more pennies on natural and organic products. He created a system in Whole Foods that, gosh, to my knowledge, it's really unlike any other Fortune 500 company out there because it's so decentralized. They push the power in the company out to the furthest reaches so that individual managers in a, you know, in a deli department in the Cottonwood Heights store can make decisions that are affecting her or his department and not have to take orders from the central office in Austin. And as big as Whole Foods has become, I guess they're probably near about $12 billion right now, that system has not broken down. They've been able to hire a very motivated workforce and make everybody feel like they're running their own business. So that's really kind of the major reason I think that Whole Foods has become so iconic and so successful. And, you know, they've been parodied on The Simpsons. I can't think of any honor that's greater than that.
Yeah. Talk about the cost, though, of organic food. Has the industry convinced Americans that they have to pay more to get this kind of food? I would think maybe naively that if you're not highly processing something, it really ought to cost less.
And yeah, doesn't it seem that way?
And yet people know that they're going to pay more for their cart of groceries in a natural food store, and quite a bit more sometimes.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, as a marketer, when I was running marketing for Whole Foods and Sprouts and writing ads, I would often turn to a line very similar to the one that you just used and say, you know, wouldn't you think that with all of those extra ingredients in a conventional food that it would cost more? But it doesn't, because they're just cheap fillers. They've taken a lot of the real food out, and they've substituted it with other things. In fact, I tell a story in the book about a product that was developed in the 60s called Merlinex, and it was called by its manufacturer Instant Anything because it could be sort of used to create phony fig paste in fig bars or imitation strawberry filling or brownie texturizer or Colby cheese. Really, really cheap ingredients instead of using the more expensive natural ingredients. So, yeah, I mean, your question is an excellent one, and I think to this day, the answer is no. I don't think we've been able to fully convince the American public that spending those extra dollars is the right trade-off for them, because at this point, natural and organic foods, with the pendulum having swung from our grandparents' generation when it was 100% or nearly 100% to the post-World War era when it was almost eliminated, to now, we're only back at about maybe 6% of all food is natural and organic. Now, it's still growing very, very fast. It's projected to double by the end of this decade. And with scale, the prices have come down, and in many cases, they are nearing parity with the conventional counterparts. So that's a good sign. And I think the last number I saw was something like 83% of families in the United States at least sometimes buy organic foods.
Yeah, I think the grocery business is kind of notoriously they operate on very thin profit margins. Do the natural food purveyors get a higher profit margin because they're charging more?
They do have a slightly higher profit margin, but it's still a pretty thin one. So, you know, in Park City, you've got a store like Fairweather Natural Foods, which is just a little one-off store that doesn't have the scale and the buying power that a Whole Foods does or Sprouts does. And the only way they can survive is to charge prices that are a little bit more, because that sustains their operations and their higher customer service and their labor levels and things like that. These bigger chains like a Whole Foods or a Sprouts or a Earth Fair or other ones around the country have been able to rectify that situation a little bit. You know, one thing to keep in mind is that there is, at this point, still no definition, no federal definition from the FDA about what is a natural food, much as there was no definition for what was an organic food for many, many years until 1990, when the Organic Food Production Act was finally passed, and it wasn't implemented actually until 2002. So up until that point, in the organic world, states had their own laws. and you could see, you'd go into a Fairweather Natural Foods, and on the shelf you might see right next to each other, side by side, something that said that it was California organic, something that said that it was Colorado organic, and something that said that it was Pennsylvania organic, and they all meant different things. And so that, understandably, made consumers very suspicious that maybe this organic stuff was just a marketing ploy for raising the retails. Eventually, we got the national standardization that we needed so that organic meant the same thing everywhere. And I think that contributed to a much greater level of confidence and a higher faith in consumers that they were getting a product that was superior in value and that was worth forking over a little bit of extra money for. And now natural is probably heading in that same direction. There's a consensus for what it means in the marketplace, but I think that there's some consumer skepticism, and understandably so. So if the FDA does begin to move on that, and if we are able to continue to show consumers out there that this is better for them, it's better for the planet, it's better for the people who are making the foods, then I do think you'll see the scale that is necessary, and hopefully we will reach that point at which there really is no cost premium.
Hey, I'm going to ask one last quick question because we're running out of time, and maybe, well, I know it wouldn't have a quick answer, but try to make it one, and that is, are some additives good? I mean, should, you know, I just think of last year of 17 or 18 people dying in from eating Colorado cantaloupes and E. coli and food and so on. Can a case be made that some additives are good?
Sure. I think that in raising livestock, there are times when you want to have some drugs at your disposal to be able to help the animals. And I think in combating weeds and pests and things like that, there are additives, preservatives, fungicides, things like that, that can be very helpful and find the right balance between health and economics. But keep in mind, there are many, many natural versions of those. And in fact, even under the federal organic law, there are permissible substances that help with all of those things without having to resort to all of the miracles of the laboratory and the synthetic additives. So I'm very optimistic about where we are right now, given where we've been. And I think the folks who are listening to a show like yours, who are have a lot of financial acumen, I can understand that there's a difference in the products that we're offering out there.
Well, that's a great way to end this conversation. It's really fascinating. We've been talking to Joe Dobro, the author of Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business.
That has to be the longest subtitle for a book we've had yet.
Wasn't my choice. Just Natural Profits.
Okay. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes.
Larry, Beth, thanks for having me on. It was really a pleasure.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Did you know that by shopping locally, you're supporting trail maintenance, our free bus system, and the many wonderful cultural and recreational opportunities in our community? When you shop or dine in Summit County, those dollars stay right here in Summit County. The Park City Chamber Bureau is pleased to support KPCW's locally grown radio show, Mountain Money. Remember, keep it local, keep it PC. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
I want to thank you, Beth, for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
And want to thank Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design for sponsoring public affairs programming and Mountain Money. This is KPCW Park City.